Hello.
Industry Tactics. Hi, everybody. Welcome back to Industry Tactics. Your loyal host, Friendly Rich, here. And on the podcast today, none other than Charles Spearin, the great Charles Spearin, leader of the Happiness Project, one of the founding members of Do Make Say Think, worked with Gord Downey, of course, his work with Broken Social Scene. We get into so many interesting nuggets. Who knew we were talking with another fellow graduate of the Harris Institute for the Arts? That's exciting. Yeah, learned a lot. And Charles, thank you for coming on the podcast. If you're listening in real time, this Sunday, March 31st, 2024, come out to the Cameron House. I'll be joined by special guests. The great Michael Ward Bergeman coming up from the United States, joined by Dave Clark, special guests Michael Herring, and of course the Lollipop people at the Cameron House in beautiful Toronto, 7 to 9 p.m. So go to friendlyrich.com to learn more about that. But enough about that. We want to thank our friends at Guelph, CFRU in Guelph, for broadcasting the show. It's syndicated on CFRU every Monday at 12 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can listen, CFRU 93.3. And here it is, episode number 177, my delightful chat with none other than Charles Spearin.
I think what could be one of the most winned Juno Award winning artists we've had on the podcast yet, Mr. Charles Spearin.
Hello, hello.
How many Junos, not to put you on the spot, but you know how many.
Well, I have seven little statues.
That's so great.
One of them has got my name on it. The others are bands or projects that I've been in.
Okay. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Are you proud?
I am. At first I was not so excited about the Junos because I felt it was celebrating the industry a bit more than the community of music. And
lovely.
You know, the music industry in Canada has a little bit of a, you know, it's not a smooth history to it. And so I wasn't fully on board with jumping into that community.
Yeah.
Because my community has always been a bit more local and a little bit smaller and a little bit more supportive. So at first I was very hesitant about winning a Juno, and I didn't feel like I didn't really want to be part of that world. But gradually I got to know more and more people in the music industry and had a bit of a better feeling about the whole thing. So
yeah.
Now I'm all into it.
Oh, that's a great answer. I'm so excited to speak with you. Just the more I get to learn about all that you've done in your musical adventures, let's have fun for the next hour, shall we?
Yeah, I'm in.
One of Canada's prominent current mustaches, we're going to say, yes? Like...
Yeah,
not to comment on your physical, but it's a beautiful thing.
Why? Thank you.
Yeah.
I had a beard like you, and then I shaved everything except the mustache 20 years ago, and it's just kind of as a joke. And
I look up to you. I look up to you. So listen, where to begin? I got no script in front of me. I have a few notes, but why don't we begin with, where you're kind of at right now and your new release, and maybe work our way back a little bit.
Sure.
People will know, they can Google all of your accomplishments from of course, Broken Social Scene. And this episode pairs nicely with the David French episode, episode number 68, gentle listeners, nice. if you want to connect some of the dots in these prior interviews. And I'm sure Rebecca Hennessy, Dave Clark, and many others that we collaborate with and have been on the podcast. This music for 32 cell phones played simultaneously. Please.
Yeah.
Let's begin there, shall we?
Okay. Well, it was released as an album just last week, 2 weeks ago, something like that. But really the point of it was a concert, and I needed some way to get all of these parts into the hands of the audience, because I wanted the audience to kind of be a symphony and play all the individual parts of the symphony on their phones. So the idea kind of came to me once with playing a band called Do Make Say Think, and one of the things that our guitar player used to do is he had this great old recording of Patti Page doing the Tennessee Waltz, and he had a little recording of it on his dictaphone, mm-hmm. and he would hold it up to his guitar pickup and then mm-hmm. play it through his speaker, mm-hmm. and it sounded like it was coming from another world, and it was just so beautiful. And then I think that little dictaphone got stolen or something like that on tour. And I was trying to think of how cool it would be if we could maybe get the whole audience to play that song on their phone. At the end of the show, if everybody could just start. And that just seemed kind of an impossible thing to prepare for. But then it got me thinking about what would it sound like if everybody played the same thing on their phone at the same time, yeah. or what would it even sound like if it was divided up into parts? And so I wrote a little bit of a symphony kind of based on the idea of a singular being a part of a whole, like, mm-hmm. like in part of this piece, if you were to listen to one track, you just hear a cricket mm-hmm. or a single voice mm-hmm. or a single glitchy synth sound. But when they're put all together, you get a field of crickets and it puts you into a certain place, or you get a choir. Mm-hmm. So the idea was kind of taking apart, like I had even thought of maybe adding like single raindrops, so it sounds like a whole field of rain. But I just wanted to play with the idea of separating out, you know, collectives into their little bits and see what it sounded like. So I don't know if people are going to listen to it much, because it takes a bit of effort. It takes a bit of organization to get 32 people or more. When I did it, there were 300 people there, and it was pretty cool.
And so what, with the 300 people, did you divide them in sections of like, you're all part of the one group, two group, and you went up to, is that how you did it? Kind of?
I did it. Well, if you look at the names of the songs on the album,
yes.
There's a song like Cabbage Town Fox. And then so it's all divided up into neighborhoods and animals. Mm-hmm. So basically I just said, if your name begins with A or B, then you're a raccoon. If your name begins with C or D, then you're a squirrel. And I kind of went through divided the alphabet up into common names.
Yep. Yep.
And then I divided the audience into neighborhoods like Parkdale, Bloor Court, Cabbage Town, Leslieville. So everybody could just go to their song and press play at the same time. And, it worked fairly well. It was a little quieter than I had expected.
Did you cue it on 1, 2, 3, 4, go?
Yeah, it was just 1, 2, 3, go. Yeah.
Wow. And it was a little more, it wasn't as loud as you wanted, because some of them were using Androids and some of them were using.
I just thought that having 300 phones going at the same time would have a little bit more volume to it. But it's, you know, I just didn't do the math. It's really, there's not a lot of decibel information happening. So I think it works. I've tried it in smaller rooms with the group of friends, not the whole 32, but it works really nicely in a small classroom or something like that, for example.
Okay.
Have you done it with
young school children, with a group of 32 grade 4 kids?
It's brand new, so I have not.
Okay. That sounds like a cool adventure. And I get you on the, like, if you could somehow, and it wouldn't be that much work to get every phone plugged into a mixer and then just. But is that kind of like
the point is anyway, to keep it, right? keep it simple and keep it so you know, like in a small town where there's not much going on, like a bunch of people can get together and do this for fun. You know, it's supposed to be kind of simple.
Okay. Okay. Forgive me. Do you have a, I don't know enough about you. Do you have, but it sounds like you're teetering into like a world of, sound art, education though. Where I wanted to go with that question was, have you done much of that in your work? Like just even organizing 300 people to play that sounds like, well, it's musical leadership. We know you have that. But have you led that into the classroom enough?
No, not much. I have not taught music. I've had a few, you know, guitar students and things like that over the years.
Okay.
But no, I haven't done any teaching to speak of.
I love your brain. I mean, I was just preparing for this interview yesterday, speaking with Dave Clark about it, and he kind of was just saying how beautiful it was. That was the ending of your, was it Wavelength that you did? It sounds magical. Is this project as far as you've delved into the world of weirdo? I almost swore. conceptual art.
Well, not, let's see, in 2010, I released the album called The Happiness Project, which was, based on the cadence of people's speaking voices. And so I would take the cadence of people's natural speaking voice and play it on different instruments and have friends come and play it on different instruments. And you know, that's really common now on YouTube or whatever. There's tons of people doing. There's a whole movement of it, which is amazing. So that was maybe my first kind of. I mean, it's hard to say. Like my band Do Makes They Think is a fairly experimental band. You know, our songs can be 20 minutes long, and so we've always kind of ridden the line between, you know, rock and roll and sound art. You know,
I feel that. I used to collide with. Is it Justin that you were referring to earlier? Yeah,
yeah.
In the old days of hanging out with Mal Havoc. I guess we have another, hang on a second now, gentle listeners, go back and listen to episode number, if you'd like, James Cavaluzzo, episode 94, to learn more about the adventures with Mal Havoc. But
I might have to listen to that one.
Oh, it was fantastic. And he was, it was a fascinating discussion with James, but Justin came up in that talk as well, just of, that world back then, you know. And so you were early days with, like, you are one of the founding members of Do Make Say Think. Let's go all the way back there. What was that like for you, those early days in Toronto coming up and just being part of all of that?
It was a pretty special time. I think, I was in bands before Do Make Say Think, like right from high school. I played in rock bands and punk bands, and I was in a band called the Dead Lemmings for a long time, which was super fun. And like, I was 17 years old when we played Lee's Palace, and then we did shows all around the city, started other bands. And then there was a kind of...
Where did you go to high school?
Northern Secondary at Mount Pleasant and Eglinton there.
Oh yeah. Okay. Okay.
And actually two of the members of Do Make Say Think, are still high school buddies. We were in a band in high school, the Dead Lemmings, and they're still like, Ohad Benjitrit and Dave Mitchell. I've known since high school, playing together since high school. But anyway, we had these bands, and, it was tons and tons of fun, but there was always a sense of like chasing after something, like really like trying to find like more success, more fame, like all of this, you know, the kind of things that you normally get caught up in. And it felt after a while, it started to feel kind of impossible because there's so many bands and there's so many gatekeepers to getting on the radio, and you have to sort of fit into some kind of formula.
Yeah.
And it got to be a little frustrating. And then playing music with Justin Small and James Payment, who were my roommates at the time, it just had this sort of, we had this liberating sense of just playing music for the sake of playing music together. And, right. And that project became Do Make Say Think. We would play songs that were 20 minutes long that had no changes. It was like going for a walk. It wasn't like trying to create a great grand piece of art. It was more like, this is a reasonable way to live. Like, music doesn't have to be a presentation. It can be a part of who you are and how you live. And that was a real kind of eye opener for me to live in music as not as something that you're kind of showing to the world, but just a way of being in the world. So we booked a gig. I booked a gig without telling the band. So we did that one gig at Lee's Palace, and then we just kept getting invited to play more and more shows. We got invited to play raves where there's, you know, like electronic music playing at 5 a.m. and everybody's dancing. We would be in the chill out room, like all the kids who are freaked out on MDMA or whatever would need a break, and they would go into the chill out room where there's a bunch of couches, and then Do Make Say Think would be playing very quiet music on, you know, delayed electric guitars and stuff. And so it had this different kind of, like, there was no songs really at the time. And so we just kept playing and playing and playing because we kept getting invited to more and more places, more and more shows. And then eventually Constellation Records found out about us and came to one of our shows and asked us to join them on their label. So the nicest part about Do Make Say Think in the early years was that there was no kind of pursuit. You know, there was no kind of like getting your ego involved in it and trying to be famous or all that kind of thing. It was more like invitation after invitation and continuing to just play music because it feels good. So it felt like, it felt honest. It felt very honest. And somehow we managed to keep going, you know, like we've made, I don't know, 6 or 7 records, or 8 records.
Like to this day, right? Like it continues.
It continues.
It's like friends and family.
We're not the hardest working band right now, but we're still a band.
I saw, you know, I just read the line, and I started reading this book by Robert Fripp on guitar, and I feel like I could put it down because the first line in it is basically like, and I'm paraphrasing, but it's like, don't work so hard. So who cares about the hardest working? I don't know who the hardest working band is, but they're doing it all wrong. is basically. I love it. I love it. We're getting it here from the source. This is a big episode, gentle listener. What an honor to hear all that. Like, what is, you know, you've led, and I'm not, you're leading is the better way to put it. A life in music and creativity. And you're painting a picture there because I want to ask you what you love the most about that. But before I do, and don't worry, I got it written down. So you're safe. But before I do, like the question is really like, you mentioned ego earlier, and it seems like you've stayed far the hell away from it. Like, you learned that early, that that's not really the point of this. And in a way, I see it as a through line in all of your work. It's like, you're interested in bigger things. You're almost irrelevant to the stories you're telling, which is really charming. There's no question in there. You want to find a comment.
I mean, ego is a slippery thing. It sort of sneaks into whatever you're doing, and you feel, you know, if being anti-ego becomes your personality, then it suddenly becomes ego. Like it's it's sneaky. Like I still find I find when there's like some kind of identity in the work, then it's a distraction. I find that the music comes best when there's no kind of identity involved in it. Like it's just the sound and how it makes you feel, and listening to the emotions of the music is when I find it's the most real, and that's what I try to follow. But of course I'm human and I like getting patted on the back and I like praise and I like all this kind of stuff. So that does guide me sometimes, and I try not to let it guide me, but you know, I'm a normal person and I feel like I feel like I want to get to, you know, those little dopamine rushes of love.
Yeah.
Nice. So ego is there. Ego's very sneaky and it gets into everything. So right. I wouldn't say that there's, you know, that there's no ego in my music. I would just say that it seems best when ego is out of the music.
How have you kind of learned that? Has it been through the practice of just making the stuff along the way, or like, how have you come to this?
It is a lot of practice. I mean, I also, I did a lot of meditation when I was in my 20s. I was quite a dedicated Buddhist for a long time. My dad was a Buddhist, and I just got interested in meditation retreats. So I was a monk for a brief spell. I studied and read and traveled and did a lot of Buddhist practice and study until my kids came along, and then they kind of became the practice. It was sort of around the same time my career and my family kind of took over my life. And I don't know if that's...
I like that.
I don't know if it's coincidence or what caused what. Maybe because I've been doing so much meditation that you know, family and career, you know, grew from that. Or maybe family and career took away from the meditation. I don't know what it was. But there was definitely a lot of self-exploration, and you know, a big part of Buddhism, maybe the heart of Buddhism, is that there is no self. That ego is the cause of suffering and the cause of pain. So the more you look into who you are, and you find that you're mostly a series of habits and not so much a solid core that's going through all these things. So anyway, I could talk Buddhist philosophy for a long time, but that maybe touches on your question about
I didn't know that about you, and so thanks for sharing that. And like, yeah, like I am kind of intrigued by that and how it collides with our music industry, and this being the Industry Tactics podcast, I would say there is probably more we could explore there, just because every little, you know, from booking a gig to dealing with every day, it's a different dance with a different set of people, and it's all people, and you seem to really navigate people well, from what I can tell. Like how do you mentioned having friends from high school. I don't. Not that I can think of. My wife, so no, never mind. I do. I'm in that club. But like, yeah, how do you, have you had to burn a lot of bridges along the way, or like,
no,
like friction, like, well, I don't know. Is that there, or has this kind of helped you in your perception and the way you've navigated through it?
I mean, it's there. I think like being in a band, like do makes
it hard stuff. Yeah,
it's difficult. Yeah, there's it's not just, you know, for example, Broken Social Scene, which is a huge band. You know, when we're touring, there's 12 of us on the bus together, and the likelihood of there being some conflict between those 12 people is pretty high, especially when you consider that each person is constantly somewhat changing personalities. So there's going to be some conflict. There's going to be some headbutting. And then
are you changing personalities, or are you pretty
consistent? Oh, yeah, everybody does. I mean, like, I don't mean dramatically, but
okay.
I'm a certain type of person with a certain type of person. And I managed to be a bit of a chameleon and blend in with you know, the friends that I have, or like when I'm hanging out with my mom, for example, it might be a different person than when I'm hanging out with, you know, my high school friends or something like that. Everybody changes, you know, nobody has one solid permanent personality. Mm-hmm. In fact, personality, interestingly, persona, if you think about the word persona, per it means through, and sona is sound. So it actually, the word persona means mask. It's like you're talking through a mask. So if you have a personality, it's like a mask that's kind of stuck on your face or something like that.
Man,
so
we are getting it from the source. I think the mustache is talking to me. You're hitting me. This is powerful. I will stop on that, by the way.
Okay.
Nothing but love. This is amazing. So let me get back to the question. What do you love most about a life in music and creativity that you have? It just seems from the outside looking in that you are just enjoying it all. What do you love the most of all that it brings?
It's hard to quantify that kind of thing. You know, like, how do you quantify love? Like, what is my favorite aspect of my life? It's a pretty, it's not a very scientific question. It's more of like an impulse, but there's so much, I mean, it kind of comes down to two things, I think. I mean, I love being inspired by other musicians. Like, I go to shows a lot, and I come home feeling like alive. I feel like a kind of optimism for humanity when I go to see live music, and I feel like all the creativity that gets put into it. And there's so much great music in this city. Like, I just like several times a week, I can go out and come home feeling better about the world because there's so much good music.
Love
and
it.
I feel like it's just, there's so basically that there's this kind of nourishing quality that I get from seeing other people explore art in their own way. And it makes me want to do more of my own. And the other aspect is more of my own personal kind of getting lost in the work. Like, when I'm playing an instrument, or when I'm composing on Pro Tools or whatever, there's this kind of just getting absorbed in the work itself, where it's like walking down a new pathway, or like going for some kind of adventure. Like, it's captivating, and I just love working. And I love working when I get involved in a place where I'm not fantasizing. I'm just listening and reacting to the emotions of what's happening, like picking up a guitar and playing it. Sometimes you hit a couple chords and you hear it in your emotions. You hear, oh, there's this, like, oh, that feels like something I haven't felt in a long time. What is that? And then you sort of explore it. So you're listening with your emotions as much as you're listening with your ears.
Yeah.
And that, I'd say those two things, like being inspired by other people, and then going home and exploring the world of sound and emotion, is really good.
You have a real muscle for, production, and I think we see you today in this Zoom call. At least, well, I'm going to paint the picture. There's a is that your workspace? Is that your studio?
It is. This is my studio. It's humble, but it's very functional.
I was going to say, how important is that space for you? Like, is it kind of a little sanctuary in your life?
Well, before the pandemic, it was really just a rehearsal space. I had my garage as a rehearsal space for my bands. And then I would have my computer set up in the house so I could be with my family and not feel like I was, you know, disappearing into the woods or something like that to work. Cause I like, you know, having my kids running around, it wasn't distracting for me. I can do that. But then during the pandemic, There was no rehearsing going on, so I moved my computer back into the garage and ended up turning it into more of a recording studio. And it's been pretty great since. I mean, my kids are older now; they're 18 and 20, so I'm not doing a lot of active parenting. So I can come into the house, into the garage, and work the day away. And it's pretty spectacular. I have what I need. I have lots of instruments. I have a bunch of fun toys, and basically it's enough that I can really follow my follow my passions.
I feel like you were on a. I wanted to lead you there or get there with you in terms of like your approach to production, because I know you've done that's a big part of your work too. How do you go about how do you go about pursuing projects with different personalities and your persona? Start using your terminology.
I usually people ask me to produce something or I'm working on my own things. I'm not out trying to get work as a producer.
I like that. It comes naturally, eh? Like you're not going, hey, if you're ever thinking of.
No, I'm not.
I'm going to stop now. I was going to say that mustache ain't sleazy, which. Okay, I'm done. Any more mustache comments? You cut me off. Just hang up on me straight up, okay? Please.
I might have to put a filter and make myself look like a cat or something like that.
So you're not going out soliciting. It just comes to you. Which I think is beautiful, as it kind of should be. Yeah.
Yeah. I've also been in the game a long time, and I don't really need, I don't need to do that. If a project comes my way and it sounds interesting, I'll take it up quickly. Yeah. I'm not out trying to, I don't even really like working too much, especially on other people's projects. Like I feel that should be kind of a special thing. Like I don't ever want to make it a day-to-day job where I don't want there to be drudgery in it. That's all I'm saying.
Okay.
I really enjoy working with people, and I think that's because I'm not working so much.
Well, that back to that Robert Fripp line. I was very moved by that line, because it's like, I think we in our society at large love that look of like, oh, the busy, look how busy the artiste is.
Yeah.
But really it's like, I don't know how noble it is. I don't know how noble it was that Frank Zappa would keep his door closed. And it's like almost the antithesis of what you were describing earlier of like not seeing his family and like having to slip notes under the, like, is that admirable to just be neglecting your kids through the love?
No, I don't think so, but it's understandable. Yeah. Like I was saying, you want to get lost in your work. But at the same time, you got to live in the world, and it's nice to try and find the porous, boundary.
How did you balance that, or how do you balance that when you're on the road, like touring and family and all that? How tips?
Well, for one thing, my wife is wonderful. She's very supportive and has always been extremely supportive of what I do. And so for years I would be on the road, sometimes half of the year, not at a time, but like I'd come and go so that I'd only be around for 6 months of the year. Which is, tough. So she was essentially single momming it quite a bit. But then again, when I was home, I was really home. Like, it's not like I had a 9-to-5 job and would see my kids in the evenings and weekends. When I was home, I could actually be with them. And, so I felt like I had a very good, tight relationship with my kids, but then I would disappear and my wife would have to take care of all of it. And so that was, having a strong, capable, loving partner is no small thing. That's pretty amazing.
Amen. Amen. Yeah. Amen. I think about, I was just telling Dave this, the same thing yesterday, just like, how many times does that And now we're going to turn this into a podcast all about the power of a healthy relationship and the institution of marriage.
All right, we're in the relationship advice part.
You know what? I think I'm going to make that like a part of my thing moving forward, because like whether or not I believed it or was passionate about it before, like I kind of almost take it for granted in a way. But it's like, how many times my personality have I been like on the edge of like releasing a really dangerous song or a dumb idea that didn't need to go into the world? It's like basically like an angry tweet turned into a song, which I have that personality, and God bless my wife for like, just, you know, you don't need a manager. You just need like a loving partner who you know and trust and can guide you in that way and help you and support you. And that goes into so many different avenues of that. So I think I'm going to, that's a theme I think that should be explored further on this podcast. It sounds like you've really, I don't know. I loved your answer. So thank you. I mean, then that can't be easy, but you know, I also think like everybody's lifestyles are so different that 6 months away, compared to a 9-to-5 job, I think if you do the math on that, I think you're still coming up like hours put in wise still ahead. So lead as quirky and creative a life as you can, gentle listeners.
Yeah.
but be there for your family, of course. How do you define community? I know we all have different definitions for that. I'm interested in yours.
It's a bit, I mean, it's a bit of a flexible term. I don't think it, like, you know, a small town can be a community, a group of musicians or music listeners that go to clubs all the time and run into each other all the time can be a community. Like there's different parts of community. I feel like the main underlying theme is support, is this kind of support for each other. It's not competition. And that was one of the things that really drew me to Broken Social Scene in the early time. Well, it didn't even draw me to it. It educated me about the idea of not being competitive in music. Because in my early days with the punk band, we wanted to be the best band, and we wanted, like, you know, it was competitive and fun. Mm-hmm. But when I started working with Kevin Drew, and he kept inviting people in, like, we had a band called Casey Accidental before Broken Social Scene, and he just kept inviting players in, and I'm like, well, I can play guitar, we don't need to bring in another guitar player. And he's like, no, let's just get him in to see what his part might be, or her part might be. It felt more and more inclusive. And then I've started to feel that everybody else would get excited about it as well. So there's this kind of mutual support where you invite somebody in because you respect what they're doing. And then they, it's a sort of a natural human thing that when you're involved in something, you're going to like it more. And so all these people get involved in the music and then they feel good about it. And then people like myself feel good that they've added to it, and it's kind of making a whole stew that you couldn't really make on your own, and it has a distinct flavor to it, which is surprising. It's not like you're chasing. You know, a lot of people when they make music, they have like a vision of what they want it to sound like, mm-hmm. and I feel like that's kind of dangerous because it will never quite be as perfect as it is in your mind.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're open to the possibility of new influences and change, mm-hmm. and then you're continually sort of reacting to the music as it's being created, then you find more excitement in it, more surprise, more kind of playfulness to it. It's more of a living thing rather than trying to build a a replica of what's in your mind. So community, coming back to your question, seems to be this sort of allowing this kind of playfulness to exist with support, to support each other and bounce ideas off of each other. And
love it. I love that.
Yeah.
You, in a way, I feel like Broken Social Scene, with all of its offshoots, almost acts as a universe or a community unto itself. Definitely, it is, in a way. It kind of, yeah, I kind of heard that in the midst of all that, is like, I think community, and I've never thought of a, yeah, of course, that plays in it. It seems like such an important family or group, a second family or group in your life. I love the way you do what you do, because it's not the only avenue, but it's a big one. So I guess that juggle for you, you're not a normal, you know, like a typical, I guess, are there any typical artists in 2024? But I mean, it's definitely one of your main pursuits or commitments.
It's kind of my bread and butter, basically. Broken Social Scene has been more successful than I expected, any of us expected. Well, maybe, I mean, it was a real gift to have that kind of success and be able to tour and have people come to the shows and clap their hands and cheer and give us their money and that kind of thing. Like, that was a nice surprise, given that that was never my intention at the beginning of it. I was like, I just wanted to play music with my friends. And,
do you remember meeting those guys, like, at first? Like, how did it all kind of early days come together?
I did for a year. I went, sound engineering school.
Harris?
I went to Harris.
Don't tell me we've got Harris alumni on the... We've got Harris alumni on Industry Tactics. Bo Cairo?
Oh my God, yes.
We've got Bo Cairo disciple. So you know how to wrap a cable. Those cables behind you all have memories. They have trauma.
Yeah.
They have trauma. Digress.
Yeah.
Pep 1 or Pep 2? You did Pep.
I did Pep. I can't remember.
He's got Pep. Keep going. I digress.
Okay. but also Kevin Drew went to Harris, and that's where we met.
No kidding.
Yeah. He was in the artist management program.
Holy cow. He was in RAM.
He was in RAM. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he was in RAM and I was in Pep. And
this is the best. This is the best. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
It was actually, I mean, I wouldn't...
What year is this?
95? 96? Okay. 95, 96.
I think I'm like 98, 99, I go there.
Well, I wouldn't sing the praises of the school too loudly. I felt it was problematic.
This whole podcast is satire on the idea of like, who cares about how to wrap a cable? Anyway, no disrespect to Bo Cairo. I need to have him on the podcast, but go ahead.
Yeah, but that year there were quite an excellent crop of students, so I got very lucky if there was anything good about the school, it was a chance to meet new people and network, so to speak. Yep. I don't like the word network, but that's what it was. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Wow.
And so I met Kevin there, and he invited me into his band.
Okay.
And then he sort of ditched the rest of his band and just stuck with me. And then we started KC Accidental, which then grew into Broken Social Scene. And, you know, all the people we met along the way, and are still, we're still bringing people into Broken Social Scene.
There
it's
you
still
go. There you go.
Changing and evolving and all that. So, yeah.
Fantastic. I didn't expect it. And I'm sorry for my reaction, because it was a little too excited.
Yeah.
We're going to wrap up soon, but I do want to ask you one quick question. Can we play the entire, you said it was released as a 17 minute, because we haven't really cut to your music at all in this podcast, but I have a goal to try to end with the 17 minute experience. Can we do that? Or is that
it? We cannot. It does not exist in the world. In fact, I've only ever heard it, once, and that was at the Wavelength. I mean, I do have my own like Pro yes. Tools version of it, but that's not accurate. That's too accurate. It's meant to be kind of.
And you wouldn't actually want it to be experienced that way. Like the point is, we have to get a class of 32 grade 4 children.
Yeah,
and do it.
The point is to get people together. Yeah.
Okay. I get it. I love that. We'll play something else.
Play something else. I've got a lot of stuff out there.
Yeah. So what you know, you've done a lot, you're on the Secret Path recording,
yeah.
You've seen a lot, you know, through the years. What, what was that like, first of all, that experience, working on that project?
Yeah. Secret Path is Gord Downie's, not his last album, but one of his last albums that he did, about, Chani Wenjack, the First Nation, indigenous kid who, was, brought to stolen from his home and brought to a residential school. And he escaped from the school and tried to, walk 700 miles home to his family, and froze to death along the way. And Gord Downie was really moved by this story. I think there's an article about it in the paper, and it was just sort of stayed in the back of his mind for a long time. And then Kevin Drew was working with him on his album, and Kevin invited myself and Ohad, my high school friend who plays in
There You Go,
Broken Social Zine, and Do Mix, I think, and he's been a big part of my life forever. So the two of us went out there to the bathhouse to record with Gord Downie on his album. We didn't know that there was a real theme to the album at this point. We just helped write the music and then Gord would sing the lyrics on top of it, and the lyrics, he didn't really let on that the whole album was a concept album while we were making the album. He had that in his mind, and he was just looking for the right music to support it. So we thought it was just making a solo album, not like this like incredible, brilliant, moving. Mm-hmm. I don't know if the listeners have not heard The Secret Path by Gord Downie. It is a force. That is a very, very sad and incredible album. Mm-hmm. And I'm very thrilled and honored to be part of it. And then we toured it. We did a handful of shows together. And we connected with so many indigenous communities. And
that must loom large, eh? And you're like in...
Yeah.
You seem like you keep a lot of interesting memories through all this, but that must be one that I would assume looms large.
Very special. Yeah. Very, very special.
Yeah. Well, thanks for sharing that. I mean, we're going to wrap up, but what, I want to learn a little more before we do about your music education. Like you mentioned Harris, so we got a little bit of that, but, but like, how do you come to, is guitar your main instrument? How did you fall in love with it when you first started as a young, or were you a young boy when you?
Yeah, I was 13, and a friend played piano and wanted to start a band. So I was going to, I had some money from like a paper route or like birthday or Christmas or something like that. And I went to the Long & McQuaid garage sale, you know, back when Long & McQuaid was at like on Bloor and Robert there, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And bought a Strat guitar, like a Sunburst Strat guitar.
Oh, baby.
And it was like an L. Dagas, actually, a Strat copy guitar.
Yeah.
And then I just, you know, I learned to play Satisfaction by the Rolling Stones, and I was just so filled with like dopamine. Like, I just loved it. I was just like,
were you taking lessons or did you just pick it up?
I took lessons for a couple of years, and basically my lessons were private lessons. And I went to this guy, Rick, I can't remember his name, but yeah, he just taught me a bunch of songs, and I would come in with a song and he would listen to it and figure it out and show me how to play. Okay. And I did that for a couple of years, and that was it. That was basically my entire musical education, 3 years of guitar lessons. And then, from then on, I just would get together with friends and we would teach each other. And, I learned to play guitar mostly in front of an audience, like, cause I started playing live shows so young. And then every instrument I've learned to play, like, you know, I play trumpet, I play drums, I play guitar, bass. I have this Swedish instrument called nickel harpa, which I love. Been playing that for a long time, a decade now.
Yeah.
But my approach is always the same. I pick it up and I listen to it and I figure out what it is that, brings the most joy. And then I just follow that. And that's always been my approach.
I love it. I love it.
I'm actually taking trumpet lessons now for the first time, and it's kind of fun. Yeah, at the Royal Conservatory of Music, and I'm learning to read music at 51.
Straight up at the Royal Conservatory of Music. What makes you go there? Like do you, is that like that's almost like a, is it a 360 or a 180? I always mess that up. Well, it's from zero to 100, and it's interesting. Anything driving you specifically there? You're like, I'm taking this seriously. Is that that's what that feels
like?
Yeah,
I guess it was, yeah, I did want to take it seriously, but it was also, I'll admit it, it was very impulsive. I was walking past the building, and I walked in to ask about trumpet lessons.
Oh, how nice.
And then they connected me with Stanley Rosenzweig, who's the director of trumpet. And I emailed him. Okay. And he's the best. He's this 85-year-old New Yorker who used to play with the Rockettes. He played at Radio City Music Hall 4 times a day through the 50s and 60s. Like, damn. His stories are incredible.
Damn.
So I take lessons with him at his house, and then there's a little trumpet ensemble or a little brass ensemble at the conservatory. We get together once a week and just do some Latin jazz, you know, which is like, cause I want to learn to read. I want to learn to be a better player.
Yeah. I love this. I mean, I was going to say, like, we all have our own music educations, right? Anyone, all of the 100 and almost 200 people I've interviewed on this podcast, it's a fascinating question. And I love how you're just like, that 3 year block were the only formal lessons I had, but you are doing the thing and are you ever, and I'm interested in that. Like, that's beautiful to me that we're all on a path of constantly learning these things. Mm-hmm. Love the fact that you got a little more formal in it now.
Yeah.
See where that leads you, or if it does, but it continues to help you strengthen your approach. I mean, my question, I guess, is any regrets, and are you reconciling those regrets in a way through some of this of like, yeah, you know what, I'm going to learn how to read music. Who cares?
No, yeah. I can't really have regrets. This, like, I feel very lucky. Like, I've lived a very lucky life. I mean, yeah, things turned out better than I could have hoped, really. Like, I've so many good friends. I've been involved in so many great projects. Like, amen. I really feel lucky.
Amen.
And I can't think of regrets right now. Like, I'm not always constantly bubbling with happiness. You know, I do, like, I have, I'm still human, and I have all the, you know,
frustration.
Sometimes lie in bed and think about stupid shit that I said. And like, you know, like, I have all the normal kind of, kind of regrets, like, well, just embarrassing.
You better not have it. You better not lie in bed reflecting on the next hour, because it's been all gold here with Charles Spearin. And thank you so much for making time and opening up. And it's nice to get to know you a little better and what your story has been. What inspires you these days? Where do you want to? What are some of your future musical adventures? Do you know?
I don't know, but I'm definitely inspired regularly by some of the community that plays at the Transac all the time. Like, there's just so many incredible musicians. Yeah. The band Bernice and Tom Gill and that whole community seems to be connected to this amazing web of brilliant musicians who are really artistic and thoughtful and fun and nice. And just like, I'm really inspired by, you know, the kids. Yeah. They're like 35 or whatever, but to me, they're kids. And like, I'm just so thrilled that kind of imagination is out there. So I'm inspired by that.
Well, I respect your hunger and genuine engagement with community and the way you kind of incorporate it into your own work and the way that you feed it in the way that it needs to be fed too, in what you just alluded to there of just being an active participant whenever you can, you know, and that's a really important lesson too. So thanks. What do you, can we share, what do you feel like sharing here at the end? We'll go shopping on your Bandcamp. What do you feel like sharing with our listeners from your body of work, maybe based on our talk or maybe not?
I don't know. You could play Mrs. Morris from the Happiness Project. It's a little golden nugget of advice from my Jamaican neighbor across the street. And then Leon Kingstone following her voice perfectly on the saxophone.
Okay. I was going to ask who that was on saxophone. Neat. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, here it comes, Mrs. Morris. Go to, how can people learn about, just look up Charles Spearin, for God's sakes. Thank you.
Thank you, Rich. Nice to see you.
You too. Have a great day, Charles.
Okay, thanks.
Happiness is love. Happiness is love. Love make you keep happy. You can't just love yourself and you don't love other people. You got to love people. And love is right there. It make you feel happy to know that you're my neighbor. And I love you. And you could able to come over today to invite me over. What do you think that is? I'm feeling happy.
Same.
Yes.
It's a simple recipe.
Yes. I'm feeling happy. Good. To know that, you know, somebody cares. And that's a big love. You know, I can come out through the door and I say, good morning. What make you feel so happy? Right? Oh, love. That's what I find it is. Make you happy. I come out in the morning, I see Mr. Gary. I can say, good morning, Mr. Gary. I can sit and talk to him because I'm happy. I can go back in and I can smile and say, oh, we were changing tone this morning. Hey? So nice. So good. I love that. Love make you happy.
Well, there it was. That was Mrs. Morris from the Happiness Project that was longlisted for the Polaris Prize, and it won the Juno in 2010. None other than Charles Spearin. Thank you, Charles, for everything that you shared. That was an awesome episode. Go to friendlyrich.com to learn more about this podcast and everything else I've got cooking. And we'll see you again next time on Industry Tactics. Bye, everybody.